Welcome to the Hempfest Files. These were recorded by Zach Dodge of Dodge City Audio at the 2019 Hempfest.
Welcome to the fifth panel of the day and the fifth and final one for the Hemposium stage. There will be some things going on after that at this stage, but right now I could not tell you what those are. Seattle Hempfest is powered by your contributions. It costs $750,000 to put this on. We average 46 cents per attendee donation for the event. So if you donated $5, you'd be donating more than 10 times the average donation for the event. And if everybody donated 10 times more, Seattle Hempfest would be doing pretty well. So please consider donating at least $5 or more to the many drop boxes that we have. I think we've got one over here in the corner. All right, we shall now move to the panel. I want to explain how this is going to work. We're going to go down the line. I'm going to ask each panelist to do a more in-depth introduction to each other, too. They'll get a chance to do that. And to give a little opening statement. This one is more technically focused. We've got a lot of technical expertise on this panel. For this one, I definitely want to actually allow audience questions that are relevant to the topic and that are questions. If you start rambling on and just giving a comment, I will not allow you to continue. I will have the microphone and I will take it away. So it's very important to emphasize the panelists and their expertise up here and to give them that voice and space. So we're going to move right to that. The opioid crisis and the relationship between that and cannabis and medical marijuana. We've got a distinguished group of folks here on board today. And so we're going to start with Jake. And Jake, I want you to give a more thorough introduction. I've known Jake for a while, but I want to let him give his info out and a little opening statement, please.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for attending Hempfest and we're here for you guys, so please, again, we'd love your donations and appreciate that. My name is Jake Felice. I am a naturopathic doctor, and the opiate crisis, I think, is something that is on a lot of our minds. Cannabis offers a wonderful opportunity for the long-term chronic treatment of pain. It's not an either-or situation where a patient needs to use either just cannabis or just opiates. They happen to work very well together. If opiate tolerance is developed, cannabis can help increase its efficacy. And there are just so many things that it does that are wonderful for the practice of medicine and the treatment of pain. I'd like to get further on through the panel, but really we'd appreciate your questions and thank you for being here at Hempfest. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jake. It's a new acquaintance for me, Monty Levine.
Well, I've been a person that's been living in pain for a number of years. I've smoked cannabis for many years, and then I started going to a pain clinic and getting morphine, extended release. Then I got kicked out of pain clinic because I had a dirty UA. And I said, screw it all. I'm just going to use heroin, and I don't care. I want to be out of pain. I found for myself that when I was using heroin and smoking cannabis, I had to be very careful because the combination for me just made it like I wouldn't drive. One or the other I could, but not the combo. And I've tapered off of using heroin, using an opiate replacement, Suboxone. And during that process, I started using cannabis again. And it has helped with the pain. And I will continue to use it. As far as opiates go, I really don't like how I get treated at a pain clinic. I really think it's demeaning to pee in a cup. So And I've been very involved in overdose prevention and have facilitated syringe exchange over in Kitsap County for almost 20 years.
Thank you, Monty. So just let me ask you real quick, does what you do fall into the category of like peer counseling or like peer services for other folks trying to get off of opiates?
Yes, it has.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you.
This past year, I've helped three other people other than myself get off of opiates.
Thank you, Monty. Thank you very much. All right, Amanda Chicago Lewis, tell us about pain management and your perspective on this.
Hi, I'm Amanda Chicago Lewis. I'm a cannabis user, I'm a cannabis patient, and I'm a cannabis journalist. I write for mainstream publications like The Wall Street Journal and Rolling Stone and Wired and GQ. I've written about the need for more attention and research around cannabis as a substitute. Okay, I've written about the need for more research and attention around cannabis as a substitute for opioids. I personally, in my journey as a patient, have not been pushed towards opioids, or have just, I guess, been very resistant around it. But would love to contribute into this conversation more of a broader cultural policy standpoint of what's been going on and what that conversation looks like at federal and local levels.
Thank you, Amanda. Dr. Bierman.
Hi, I'm Dr. Dave Bierman. I'm a physician. I've been done a lot of different things in my career, about half administrative and half clinical. I've been involved on a part-time basis in drug abuse treatment and prevention for 50 years, including being one of the founders of the third Flea Clinic in the United States, the Seattle Open Door Clinic in 1967. I was a medical director of a methadone maintenance program, inpatient detox. I did outpatient detox.
David, please keep the microphone close to your mouth.
All right.
Thank you.
None of that stuff was important. I've just been around for a long time and understand that what we have done with calling this the opiate crisis is we've thrown the patients under the bus, and we really need to become more patient-oriented. I'm a longtime critic of drug policy in this country. I've written a couple of books that I hope you'll consider buying. One's called Cannabis Medicine, A Guide to the Practice of Cannabinoid Medicine. The other one's a larger book called Drugs Are Not the Devil's Tools, and in that, I explore why we have these stupid laws that we have. I want to talk, when we get around to having more time, about motivation. We need to focus on people and motivation, not on drugs. Recognize that 41% of all opiate prescriptions, at least 3 years ago, according to a speaker down in Los Angeles at Cedars-Sinai, 41% of all opiate prescriptions were written by doctors licensed in Florida. So is this a national problem? And we need to take a look at motivation. I'll talk about that later. In regards to cannabis, if we take a look at the cannabinoids, there's at least five cannabinoids that have analgesic properties. There are about 10 or 11 terpenes that have pain relief properties, and there are another 11 or 12 terpenes that have anti-inflammatory properties. And there are some other things that people can do that are sort of non-substance-based. One of the things I want you to be aware of is that in the 1920s, American doctors wrote 2 million prescriptions a year that contained cannabis, and the Remington's Principles of Pharmaceuticals, 1927 edition that tells you how to make tincture of cannabis, says that it's most commonly used for pain and anxiety. Guess what? The human body hasn't changed. It's still most commonly used for pain and anxiety. We'll talk more. Let me pass it on and not hog the mic.
Thank you. Dr. A.D. Poe, it's my pleasure to introduce you.
Hi there. My name is Dr. A.D. Wilson-Poe. I am an academic neuroscientist. I've been studying the interaction between cannabis and opioids my entire adult life. I've been funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse to study this drug interaction from everything from rodent studies, cellular and molecular physiology, and brain slices. And I currently have a collaboration where we're using the exact same principles to study pain relief in chronic pain patients, trying to, you know, mitigate their opioid use by using cannabis. really, I think my primary interest in all of this is the massive public health impact that cannabis has, specifically with regard to reducing opioid harm. You know, there are a lot of things that cannabis is really good for, and more clinical trials will tell us, you know, even more what cannabis is good for. But it's very obvious that, to me, the greatest potential benefit from cannabis is specifically its impact on opioid use. So I'm really interested in all facets of this, whether this is cannabis as a first-line pain-relieving medicine, that is, before we give them any other pain reliever, let's try cannabis first rather than the alternative. Also, in conjunction with opioids in a really severe pain state, we know that these pain-relieving drugs work together really well. And also, after opioid dependence has already developed. So once someone has been using opioids for a long time, what is the role of cannabis in alleviating opioid withdrawal and really treating all of the symptoms of what it feels like to be a person in a lifelong recovery from opioid dependence? How can we use cannabis to improve people's lives so that we can reduce their likelihood of relapsing to these very dangerous drugs? So I'm really happy to be here today. And if you're happy to be hearing about all of this, you know, really useful information and this topic in general, then I would really invite you to drop a dollar or five or ten into any donation box, because this is a really profound gathering of people. And for us to have the opportunity to discuss this extremely important public health topic with you all, I hope that you'll show your appreciation for that.
Thank you, Aideen. So I want to start by asking a question that maybe only some of you will be able to address, and we'll include incorporate the rest of you as we go along. But I'd like for you to tell us, what do we mean when we talk about the opioid crisis? Just to kind of situate, you know, the title of this panel for folks out there. I mean, Dr. Behrman said something interesting geographically about it, but what is it and what are its driving causes? So we know where we're at and how we're getting somewhere, maybe with trying to answer questions about opioid substitution. What is the opioid crisis?
Yeah.
And it might be Dr. Poe and Dr. Felice.
Sure. I can start. Yeah. So since 1991, opioid prescriptions in this country have increased 300%. So we have more people than ever consuming more opioids than ever, and that's just the legal source. Now, once we started to realize that these drugs are actually no different than heroin or any other illicit substance, that the brain doesn't differentiate between oxycodone and heroin, and these are actually really dangerous drugs, then, you know, there were all of these efforts from the pharmaceutical companies to make abuse deterrent formulations, things that people couldn't abuse and inject like they do heroin. And once we started to change how those prescription drugs looked, what that meant was those people who were physically dependent on those prescription drugs then turned to the black market and started using heroin. So we see a direct correlation, the timing of opioids that were abuse deterrent formulations directly contributed to people switching to heroin. And so we have this, the opioid crisis really started with trying to treat undertreated pain. We had an undertreated pain crisis in the late 80s, 90s. And then we had this, like, the pendulum swung all the way in the other direction, where our hyper-treatment of pain has now led to more people than ever being physically dependent on opioids. And that means that their body no longer functions normally in the absence of that drug. And what happens in that state, the only way to alleviate that state is to give the body more opioids. And so what this has resulted in, because opioids are so dangerous, because it is so easy to have a lethal overdose on these drugs, we have more people dying from accidental drug overdose than we have people dying from car accidents and gun violence. So accidental drug overdose is the number one cause of death in this country, and the vast majority of those deaths have something to do with opioids. And even those opioid deaths, still to this day, you know, despite our efforts to you know, fix this prescription opioid problem from the physician, from the CDC, we still have a lot of people who are dying at the hands of opioids. So that's like the 30,000 foot view.
Thank you, Dr. Poe.
I'd like to take...
Could you go right after Dr. Jake? He actually got in the queue.
He got his hand up.
No, he got his hand up. Yeah.
I'll be after Jake.
Okay, you're after him.
Okay, thanks. Just on a basic level, chronic pain is a huge issue for so many patients. And whether that is the demographic aging of society, sedentary lifestyle, etc., we have a lot of chronic pain. I'm sure you all can relate. Over 100 million Americans have chronic pain at any one given time and point in the year. And we, as in terms of pharmaceuticals, we don't have a very good pharmaceutical repertoire to treat pain long term. We have opiates as a class of medications, and we have also NSAIDs are the two big ones. And we're talking about opiates today, but conservatively, one in four patients has an adverse reaction to NSAIDs. An NSAID is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So over the counter, think of Advil. And so we don't, pharmacologically, we just don't have a lot of tools. When we use opiates long-term for chronic pain, we know statistically that that causes addiction. But what's really not out there in the literature is that if a patient is using opiates for chronic pain, their quality of life doesn't necessarily improve. And we now have studies showing that cannabis patients who are in chronic pain experience increased quality of life. So part of the problem is a pharmacologic problem with chronic pain. We just don't have really good tools to use for the long term. Thank you.
Okay, so I sort of want to take issue with the whole idea regarding the opiate epidemic. I call it opiate phobia. I have lots of patients who've been taking opiates for years who have good quality of life. I have lots of patients who used opiates for years and stopped using them. Clearly, there are some patients who opiates are not helpful for. But I think so long as we on the panel here talk about opiates and don't talk about motivation and don't talk about cannabis, we're not seeing the forest for the trees. And what has happened since 1991? What's happened is that we have had an accumulation of money and power at the top, and we've had a disintegration of some of the core industries in this country. One of the reasons why Florida represents 41%, or did 3 or 4 years ago, of all opiate prescriptions, I think has to do with the decline of the tobacco industry, the decline of the coal industry. Specifically, we're talking about Tennessee, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and then in Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania, again, coal, steel, automobiles, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, fishing, and forestry. And so something has changed since 1991. Not only did doctors prescribe a lot more medications, but also I think that the FDA has not done its job. A few years ago, as we cracked down on the availability of prescription pain medication and its diversion into the illicit market, we saw 20 people die in Pennsylvania because they used a concoction that had fentanyl. So if the President of the United States, whatever his name is, decides that he wants to build a wall to keep out drugs, he needs to build a wall on the Olympic Peninsula to keep the fentanyl out of China and from coming in from China. And as long as we don't focus on motivation, on why a people who have a legitimate pain, have a legitimate need for medication, why they switch to an illicit drug, I mean, I would suggest that it's because their physicians are not doing their job. I mean, I have tapered hundreds of people off of opiates mm-hmm. in my role in methadone maintenance and outpatient detox, people that I've trained as a pain management physician.
I'm afraid, one of the things I want to mention about cannabis, so I don't fall victim of my own criticism, is that cannabinoid medicine specialists have found that cannabis use decreases the opiate dosage by 30 to 50%. And in some cases, people are able to stop using opiates altogether. And I just want to mention the article that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2014 that found that in states at that time where cannabis was legal medicinally, there was a 25% drop in opiate deaths, overdose deaths, compared to those states where cannabis still remained illegal. I obviously feel very passionately about this, and so does everybody else on the panel, and I'll let them speak their passion.
Thank you, Dr. Behrman. So, we'll let Monty got his hand up first. Sorry, about it.
Okay. First, I would like to say there's a difference between dependence and addiction, mm-hmm. which is not made very often. Motivation is really important if somebody is motivated, but it's really hard to tell how somebody is motivated. I'd like to point out that one thing, when the formulation of OxyContin changed so it wasn't dissolvable, that's when we saw an increase in heroin use. Black tar heroin, very, very toxic, highly acidic. People were shooting into major veins and ruining them because it took so much. In 2010, the legislature in this state made it known that they were going to charge the Department of Health with coming up with guidelines for prescribing opiates. At that point, doctors started dropping patients like crazy. No taper. And I think those doctors have to own a good chunk of the responsibility of the increase in heroin use.
Hear, hear.
Then this law passed. But when they made that notice at our needle exchange, the number of people seeking syringes tripled within a 3 or 4 month period after that announcement from this legislature.
I was just going to really quickly say something about the sort of sociocultural perspective on all this, how we came to have an opioid crisis, okay? So if you look at medical papers from the 19th century, like 150 years ago, before we had these sort of established Western medicine institutions that we all rely on right now, and things were a little bit messier, and maybe, you know, you had some surgery with no anesthesia, and things were a little bit crazy. You look at specific doctor observations, it's very clear when they're looking at opioids and when they're looking at cannabis that there's a very specific difference between those two things, right? They both relieve pain, but opioids are much more powerful. So if your pain is worse, maybe opioids are better. And opioids are physically addictive and therefore more harmful for your body overall in the long run. That's just sort of a general what you see doctors and people looking at over 150 years ago. The same is true today. And if you think about it, you know, if you were having this like non-anesthesia messy surgery in like 1875, yeah, you probably want opioids. And if you're having surgery today, you might also want opioids. The thing that really shifted and that we're all sort of gravitating around is really the 70s, 80s, 90s, the way that deregulation of the financial industry and the closeness, as Dr. Behrman was talking about, between industry and government, creating a situation where profit-motivated pharmaceutical companies created products that were designed to be addictive so that they could sell more opioids. And that's the actual, I think, sociocultural motivation behind what we're seeing today.
Thank you, Amanda. So Dr. Behrman.
I was talking to a fellow who worked in the pharmaceutical industry, and I was asking him what he thought had changed in the last 50 years. And apropos of what you said regarding the financial markets, he said 50 years ago, the people that ran pharmaceutical companies were interested in helping people. That was a primary goal. Making money was a secondary goal. Now making money is the primary goal. I also think we need to be careful about using the word addiction. It's a slippery slope. It's like calling somebody a pejorative name. I'm Jewish, so I'll use the pejorative name for Jews. I would be pretty upset if somebody called me a kike. And if you call somebody who is habituated or has a dependency to opiates an addict, that is a pejorative name. That is a way of othering them. And that's what we're doing with the language that we have around the opiate crisis or opiate epidemic. And we are not approaching it from a scientific point of view of looking for solutions, of looking for alternatives. We're approaching it from the point of view of trying to victimize people, not only the patients, but also the doctors. And I certainly agree with the comment that you made that cutting somebody off abruptly is a formula for increasing their likelihood of abusing illicit opiates. I mean, we need to have our decision makers and our regulators know what they're doing. And if the end product that we're looking at, the regulations that we see, are any evidence of their competence, they are incompetent.
Thank you, Dr. Behrman. Dr. Poe.
So I think that this distinction between someone who suffers from an addictive disorder and labeling someone as an addict is gaining momentum finally in this country. It's something that, from a scientific perspective, we've been moving toward this for a long time. We now refer to this as someone who is suffering from an addictive disorder. And they're suffering because...
No, we don't. The DSM-5 removed the word addiction.
I just
need to correct
you. You can raise your hand, but I'd like to allow her to speak without interruption. Thank you. We'll put
you
next.
In the DSM-5.
That's okay.
So correct. Maybe the DSM-5 still says cannabis use disorder and opioid use disorder and alcohol use disorder, as you know, those are all different classifications of addictive disorders. And what I'm referring to is that there is an evolution. That yes, potentially, you know, out there in the world, addiction is still labeled this, but what I'm talking about is the future. And we know that the brain is really good at being, quote-unquote, addicted or dependent upon opioids. Opioids hijack the brain's reward system, that part of our brain that causes us to re-engage in a behavior because it feels good. Eating that burger feels good. Going on a date with that person feels good. This warm, cozy bed feels good. So our brains program us to re-engage with that behavior. And we know that opioids are incredibly good at that. They completely hijack this set of brain mechanisms and circuits. Whereas cannabis does activate those same areas, but in a totally different manner, that it isn't completely hijacking this system. So that's why we see this difference between people who very readily develop a physical dependence and an opioid use disorder, and it's much more difficult to develop a physical dependence and cannabis use disorder. Cannabis just isn't as profound at activating that part of the brain which would cause someone to have cannabis use disorder. That's still a very real thing. There are people out there who do consume so much cannabis that it has a negative impact on their life, but the number of those people pale in comparison to the number of people who are suffering from an opioid use disorder.
Thank you, Dr. Felice.
Oh, and just to add on to that, not only when we're using cannabis does it affect those areas differently, there are now studies showing that when opiates are used and activate those reward centers, CBD is effective in altering those. In fact, a single dose of CBD has a 24-hour effect, so it's an effect that actually lasts longer than it's pharmacologically active. So cannabis also has, it's a multifactorial player, and I think that one of the things we haven't really discussed on the panel is why cannabis does so many of these different things, and that include, and the reason for that is how our body's endocannabinoid system works. And when we experience pain or any type of physical stress, it is a very rapidly responding system. When it gets out of balance, that can contribute to all, we think, many different types of difficulties that can compound issues. Chronic pain is amongst those too. So,
Dr. Behrman?
We're sitting here talking about some arcane points, and we're focusing on cannabis as a medicine, which I think is good. But there are also non-pharmaceutical approaches that you can take to pain. For instance, most people don't realize that innerspring beds, which cause pressure sores, support your body on various pressure points, whereas an air mattress or a water bed or a Tempur-Pedic distributes your weight more evenly over your body. So if you wake up in the morning with aches and pains, getting one of those non-innerspring mattresses may help. The same thing is true of every time we take a step, we are shocking the joints in our ankles, our knees, our hips, and our intervertebral joints. And I've had a number of patients that have found that good quality footwear that helps with the shock absorbing of every step that we take and reduces it is helpful in reducing the pain. Finally, when I was the medical director of the oldest county organized health system Medicaid managed care program in the country, we allowed or we paid for some of our patients to get acupuncture for pain, and we used the American Academy of Pain Management acupuncture scale and found that they did get relief. And we also tried an intervention called Feldenkrais, which is sort of a combination of yoga, light, and physical therapy. And not only did we find that people had decreased pain as a result of that intervention, but that our costs went down, meaning that we paid for less doctor visits and less prescription medication. So I think, you know, I noticed, you know, the title is Strategies for Pain Management, and those strategies include not only using cannabis to treat pain, but also looking at non-pharmaceutical approaches.
Dr. Poe is next, but I want to kind of point out that, yeah, why is the conversation always about drugs when it comes to controlling pain? You know, Dr. Poe.
I can speak to that directly. So a number of the really wonderful places that I've worked over my career have had, you know, very robust pain clinics, some of the best in the world. So, for instance, at Washington University in St. Louis, you know, our pain clinic consists of dietitians and occupational therapists and physical therapists. And, yes, the pharmacy guy is there to try it. Most of the time when we're in the pain clinic, we're trying to get people off of the 12 different things that they're on, because so many of those things are only producing side effects and not having any improvement in their life at all. And so, yes, I think that the best kind of pain management is whatever, first of all, is best for that patient. Because pain itself, you know, we talk about all the time, what are opioids doing? They're removing the somatic component of pain, the bodily component of pain. But the bodily component of pain is only one side of the coin, or even a multi-sided coin. So we know that, you know, my work in the laboratory has shown that pain itself has two sides. There is that somatic, the bodily pain, but also hand in hand is the emotional suffering. This is why we see in the vast majority of chronic pain patients, they also have comorbid or coexisting mood disorders like anxiety and depression. So really that anxiety or that mood is just one symptom, of which another symptom is bodily pain, and the root cause of those things is some other central nervous system disorder. So when we're looking at any kind of pain relief, we have to be able to look at all the facets of pain. What are the kinds of interventions we can use, pharmacological or otherwise, that will look at this holistic component of pain, both alleviating the mood, the negative mood, alleviating bodily pain, and increasing the quality of life for that person, whatever that looks like. So the quality of life, the kinds of activities, and the lifestyle that different people are engaged in is going to be different, because some people are retired, some people have to sit at a desk, some people have families, you know, some people are willing to tolerate discomfort, and some people have no tolerance for discomfort. And so we really have to look at both a personalized approach to pain management as well as a holistic approach. One great thing about cannabis is that it is quite a holistic medicine. You know, we know that if we have a central nervous system disorder that produces bodily pain and emotional suffering, we have at least one substance that is really good at boosting mood, producing euphoria, alleviating anxiety, as well as providing physiological analgesia, physiological pain relief at the level of the brain. So this is why cannabis does play such a critical role in this holistic treatment of pain and chronic pain.
Monty?
Well, I wish my doctor was more like that. Because it's one size fits all. Mm-hmm. You go in and boom, boom, boom. As far as substance abuse goes, treatment, you look at treatment, individualized treatment plans, they're all the same. We don't spend the time to get to know the patient, to get to know the person, and see what's going to work.
Yeah, this also seems to be part of the problem, and this hasn't been brought up by the panel, but I'd like to kind of get your feel about notions like those advanced by Dr. Gabor Maté, that like the root of addiction actually is social dislocation and disconnection, and that actually that whatever's happening physiologically, there's a socially produced source, essentially, that happens. I wonder, like, if that's the case, then, you know, how can we talk about, you know, cannabis use or pain management is also, you know, addressing social dislocation in some way, shape, or form, or opioid use as magnifying it, that sort of thing. So take it away, folks. I've got Monty and then Dr. Jake.
I've worked for many years in substance abuse prevention with youth, and I've always said the best prevention is growing people with a healthy ego. And we do a very poor job of drug education with our youth, and quite frankly, it's about time we legalized, regulated, and spent the money we spend on incarceration, on providing education. And if somebody's using a drug and wants to come off of it, that the same door that they get their drug from should be the door that they get treatment.
The what he said is absolutely true, and I would add to education, parenting. That if you have a child where the parents don't express their concern for them, have no concern for them, have their own problems, that child is likely to have PTSD, and they're more likely to have a problem with substance abuse. There was a really holistic approach done by a pediatrician named Ira Chesnov that had to do with the use of cocaine, but I think the same findings would pan out for opiates as well. And he did a intervention that had 10 or 11 different modalities on women who had children and used cocaine during their pregnancy. And he found that those children did better in school and had a higher IQ than the children of women who didn't use cocaine during pregnancy. And that it really had to do with the interest that people were being paid, that the efforts to educate them. You know, if we actually did what we say we believe in, if we actually had values that promoted the importance of being a parent, the importance of raising healthy children, of getting people to feel good about themselves, to have good coping skills, to have a sense of self-worth, I think that those people, it seems to me, are less likely to end up with abusing drugs. Now, that doesn't mean that some people of means don't abuse drugs, like the late Senator McCain's wife or like Rush Limbaugh. But they have other things that are going on in their lives, and I think often that the abuse of opiates is a symptom of other underlying things, and we need to, as others have said, look at the whole picture, look at the whole person, and treat that person as an individual, not as one size fits all.
Thank you. Dr. Felice.
It can sometimes be hard to compare animal studies with human studies, but I think that many of us would agree that as a culture, we're pretty stressed out in general. We can take laboratory animals and we can make them addicted in the laboratory quite easily. Usually, if you're from the animal perspective, living in a cage by yourself or in crowded conditions with other animals is not ideal. When you take those same laboratory animals, you take the rats and you put them in a very different environment, let's call it a rodent spa, where there's plenty of water, wheels to play on, areas to be able to be isolated, areas to have social, good-tasting food, etc. The animals do not addict, or at least they addict at a much lower rate. So there is absolutely a component of stress to the addictive process. And also there is a component to the endocannabinoid system regarding the stress process. It could potentially be argued that if we are living in a stressful environment and there's not so much we can do about the externalities, whether that be our social, economic, or political situation, we can work on tonifying the endocannabinoid system. And it's not just cannabis that does that. It's good, healthy foods. Omega-3 essential fatty acids will do that. Exercise tonifies the endocannabinoid system. Hugs will. There's a study in women showing that singing tonifies the endocannabinoid system. So these things that we classically think of as healthy, good, meditation, osteopathic manipulative adjustments, all of these things we know benefit one of our major stress systems, which is this ECS, the endocannabinoid system. So I think a lot of the time we focus on, and this is a very complex and new idea, but we focus on the plant or we focus on the culture. But it really, the beautiful thing about what cannabinoid medicine is bringing to science is really an interdisciplinary approach. And for things like pain, which are multifactorial, we need to have multifactorial treatments, just like when we have multifactorial treatments for complex neurodegenerative diseases or diseases like cancer. It's the cutting edge of therapy, and the endocannabinoid system is changing the way we think about medicine and about the treatment of individuals and culture. So,
thank you, Dr. Felice. Any last comments before I will take questions this time, but I'm going to be very careful about getting those questions instead of statements.
I've got one last thing to add.
All right. Can we let Amanda go first?
Yeah, really fast. I think it's really hard to find the line between individual choices and structural things that are beyond any of our abilities to change, both in terms of the ways that the conditions that have been set by people in power motivated by profit that lead so many people to easily, as Monty was describing, boom, 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 end up on opioids, right? So I guess what I'm saying is I both hear what you guys are saying in terms of, you know, what happens with the rodents in the studies and with people who have difficult parents, like certainly that, you know, those sort of conditions lead people to addiction. But I also think that I want to be careful, and I think we should all be careful about like judging the individual choices that people are able to make within the boxes that they are sort of forced into, right? Mm-hmm. If you are a parent who is in the working poor and you don't have a lot of time to, you know, spend with your children, like it's very hard for, I think, someone who has more power or privilege or money to sort of look at that person, and it's not very fair to be judgmental about how much time they're able to, you know, spend hugging their children when just to survive they need to be, you know, at a job or something like that. And so I think everyone, there's a tension in what we're describing between what any individual can do in terms of their, you know, finding better doctors, finding the sorts of you know, non-medical interventions and, you know, occupational therapy, enhanced yoga, et cetera, things that you could do for your pain, buying a new mattress, and then what's sort of available to most people and what is being pushed because certain people know that they can profit off of it regardless of how it affects other people's health.
Thank you, Amanda.
So to build on that, the box that people are forced into, some, you know, looking at the evidence and how the opioid epidemic played out and where it played out specifically, and coming full circle back to your question, is addiction a disease of disconnection? And I think that we have lots of evidence to say yes, it is. And if we look at geographic areas where there is social poverty, where the textile mill closed, where the coal mine closed, where the automobile industry evaporated, if we look at those hotspots, we see a huge amount of that population which has lost all of its purpose for existing. There is no longer a good reason for a human being to wake up and feel like they're part of a valuable community. They're providing a valuable service to their town or their family. If they wake up and they have nothing to do because there is no industry, there is no work, it's extremely difficult to want to do anything, going back to this motivation. You have to have a motivation to get up out of the bed and go to work and continue on. And if that motivation isn't there because of social poverty, because of economic poverty, because of a lack of opportunity, then of course, you know, this is the perfect breeding ground for disconnection and turning to some source to cope with all of that suffering.
So one of the things that I want to mention again, and I mentioned initially, has to do with throwing the patient under the bus. And I pretty much stopped taking new patients about 5 or 6 years ago for pain management, and divested myself of some long-time patients. And, you know, I was prescribing pain medication for them because they had pain. And some of them had difficulty in getting to see another pain management doctor at all, and others of them were undertreated. We get back to the 1991 undertreatment of pain. And I think part of the issue here is that we're not just looking at a simple thing of this person is using too much opiates. And we've heard every one of us up here have talked about various aspects of the complexity of this. But I worry that when I really have pain, I may have difficulty in getting somebody to write a prescription for me for pain medication. One last thing. I have a physician friend of mine. You can't write a prescription for yourself. He played linebacker for Columbia. So he's had joint replacements in both his knees, both his shoulders, and both his hips. And golly whiz, he needs pain medication. And he said, I don't know what I'm going to do when you retire, Dave. And I'm probably going to retire in terms of pain management within the year. So my question is, as we approach opiate use disorder, and we'll have to discuss the vocabulary later on and see if we can agree to disagree. But as we approach that, we must keep in mind the people who have real pain and not punish them.
Thank you.
Do we have time for questions?
We have actually one. Monty, I would like to give you the opportunity.
Oh, I was going to say adults learn by asking questions, and we're getting short on time.
Oh, absolutely we are. Yep. So we have time for approximately one or two questions that are questions and not statements. Starts down like a statement. I will move on.
I have a question about the insurance industry and their involvement in the prescribing of opioids. And what's your comment on that as far as are they going to be allowing cannabis-based products? Is there any headway being made in that? Are you aware of any of that?
Nothing's going to happen on that until we see federal legalization.
There is one pharmaceutical preparation that has been used in Canada and the UK for about 10 years now, Sativex or Nabiximols, that is undergoing clinical trials in the U.S. It is a plant-derived product that has a one-to-one ratio of THC and CBD and other cannabinoids that's probably the closest thing that we'll see once that has FDA approval. Then maybe insurance companies will cover that. And that is a cannabis product, but that's the closest we're going to get for a long time until federal legislation changes.
I guess in regards to the same kind of thing, Marinol, which is THC, has been on the market for 30 years. And I have prescribed that for some people for pain, although I think cannabis is much better. And if you work for the film industry, they have the best insurance in the country. And I had one fellow who had rheumatoid arthritis that was getting $2,000 worth of Marinol a month for his pain. I was taking 80 milligrams of THC a day, and you know, he had to pay the $10 copay. So if you want to have insurance cover Marinol, become a movie star.
Jake.
I was just going to say that I'm pretty sure that our neighbors to the north in the Canadian healthcare system now have a variety of THC products that are paid for, and that other countries are moving forward with that, and that the fact that we are not kind of puts us almost in the dark ages to a degree, but that there is a significant, I mean, there'll be some pushback, because if somebody has to pay for it, that entity is not going to want to do that. So there will be some political pushback. I think that it's a political problem as well as, you know, scientific one. So.
Thank you, Jake. Let's move on to the next question. And let's keep it very brief, please.
All right. So how does the effects of weed, like, help with rehab from opioid addiction? How is it different from things like methadone?
I can speak to that directly. So the issue with opioid addiction or dependence really is multifactorial. So you have the body's physical dependence on the drug to function properly. So you need to replace opioids or slowly taper off of opioids. And that's exactly what methadone and Suboxone do. Because the body is physically dependent, you have to give them an external source of those opioids in order to maintain normal bodily functions like sleep and stress and appetite and all that stuff. So that's that. So there is some evidence that suggests that the cannabinoids can also support that kind of indirectly. They can treat some of the symptoms that people experience when they have physical dependence on opioids. But moreover, what Suboxone and methadone don't do is prevent people from craving opioids. So that's another major component of addiction or recovery from opioids, is the emotional component of drug craving. And unlike methadone and Suboxone, there is evidence that CBD, cannabidiol, and potentially whole plant cannabis can actually step in to relieve craving. They relieve anxiety, which prevents drug craving, which prevents drug seeking, which prevents drug overdose. So that's where really cannabis and cannabinoids and CBD in particular is very different from the opioid replacements, in that it's not directly stimulating the opioid system to keep your withdrawal in check. It is actually trying to balance all of the homeostatic processes, both physiologically and psychologically, to keep people in recovery.
So I think we need more people. Would you like to be called Dr. Wilson or Dr. Poe?
Dr. Wilson Poe.
Both. Okay. Well, at any rate, what she's saying here about looking at all of the aspects of substance misuse or abuse. And Dr. Alex Stolkup runs a treatment center in the Bay Area, and he has what he calls a wellness group. This is for people who are no longer habituated to whatever drug it was that caused their problem, and they talk about craving, and they talk about how the most recent problem they had, and somebody else in the group may have dealt with that same thing and tells them what they did. And it's an opportunity to be honest with people about these cravings, and an opportunity for people. On one week, you may have the problem and other people will help you, and next week somebody else will have the problem and you may help them. I'm not saying this.
Thank you, Dr.
This
Berman.
Is just one more ingredient. I think mm-hmm. we need the... You
appreciate that. We've got Monty over here who also wants to respond. Thank you.
This is off topic here. I brought with me today some Narcan naloxone. It's what reverses opiate overdoses. If you know anyone that's using opiates, I will train you in 5 minutes to have this on hand. If you know of somebody coming out of jail or treatment, a quarter to a third of all overdoses happen within a week of leaving treatment or jail. So I'll be in the back, and come see me.
Thank you, Monty. Big round of applause for the panel, please. And then I just want to, after we do our little picture, if you guys could just be available for like 2 minutes over there in case anybody wanted to ask you something directly. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you. a big yellow stain. Mustard squirt on my skirt. I can't stop thinking about this stain. It's stuck inside my brain. Right up here, inside my head. Like this song, this catchy song.
Yeah, when it's green, it's on.